The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the August 19th, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour. I've titled tonight's program, A Few Things We Should Not Believe, because I've got a collection of news stories that are made up of what I call phony news. It's not all news stories, but, and I think I'm going to change the title to something about phony news, because that's more direct. And, you know how after Britain and France declared war on Germany in September 1939, that what followed for about 9 months became known as the phony war, because no major fighting, combat, or invasion took place. Until the Battle of France started in May 1940, which was initiated by Adolf Hitler and his Wehrmacht forces. So what happened was war was declared by each side in September 39, but no Western power had committed to launching a significant land offensive, notwithstanding the terms of the Anglo-Polish and Franco-Polish military alliances, which obliged the United Kingdom and France to assist Poland. But they did not. We have to ask why they did not. U.S. Senator William Borah stated on September 19, 1939, there is something phony about this war, and I think that is the first use of that word phony about it. That's maybe where that word started, that description of the war started. He went on to say, you would think that France and Britain would do what they are going to do now while Germany and Russia are still busy in the East, instead of waiting until they have cleaned up the Eastern business. And at the Nuremberg trials, Alfred Jodl said that if we did not collapse already in the year 1939, that was due only to the fact that during the Polish campaign, the approximately 110 French and British divisions in the West were held completely inactive against the 23 German divisions. Well, that's Alfred Jodl, of course, was the second to the top German military commander. And he was put on, I hate to even remember that. He was put on trial at Nuremberg and actually hung. But hanged, I guess I should say. But he said that there were 110 French and British divisions in the West at the time, and only 23 German divisions. I guess you'd say, luckily for Germany, they didn't do anything. Highly decorated German general, Siegfried Westphal, stated in a TV documentary that if the French had attacked in force in September 1939, the German army could only have held out for 1 or 2 weeks. If just the French had attacked in full force, they could have only held out for 1 or 2 weeks, the Germans. So why didn't they attack? Is it because they didn't want to defeat Hitler only, but Germany for all time? You know, is it because they had other plans in mind? Could it be possible that international Jewry was in control in so many positions in these countries that and they did not want to have a quick end to this conflict? They wanted to make it into a huge war, another huge world war, in which would change the face of all these nations for all time. Well, I don't know. I'm just asking these questions. I'll have more to say about this later, but this is just a good introduction that I've just given to what these democracy-loving devils, I'm calling them anyway, will say, that they will say often the opposite of what they really think, or perhaps a camouflage of what they are really up to, or what they just want you to think. That's what they'll say. And so this continues in the news media today, which is basically a continuation of war propaganda, still opposing and blackening the name of Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist Government. Now, why, all these years after the war, does this still have to go on? Do they still have to write all these stories about Hitler and the Third Reich and so on, about how evil and bad they were? Why do they still have to do this? When has this ever been the case where so many, what, we've got 70 years now ago, and this still has to go on all the time? So there's something very powerful here that still needs to be destroyed, that still needs to be kept down. That's the way I see it. Before I get into the phony news of the past week, I want to comment on just two items that relate to past recent programs. The first item is Oklahoma's ban on Sharia law declared unconstitutional by federal judge. That was the headline. On Thursday, it said, that would have been, what is today? Yeah, last Thursday, Judge Vicki Miles LaGrange, who was appointed by Bill Clinton in 1994, placed a permanent injunction against the ban on Sharia law, declaring it to be unconstitutional. Now, this is what she said. She said, while the public has an interest in the will of the voters being carried out, the court finds that the public has a more profound and long-term interest in upholding an individual's constitutional rights. And this really brought to mind what was discussed by Vincent Renoir on the show on Saturday, this past Saturday, when he was talking about the common good as what he sees as the highest, the goal of a good society, to uphold and to put the common good as the aim of everything that's done. And he compared that to the public interest, which is what he says they call it in France today, in their republic, that they seek to do things in the public interest. And he was arguing that they were not the same. And I can see more and more, I really have a lot of respect for Vincent's mind. This is another program was on Saturday that I got some things clear that have never been clear like this before. And I have to credit him with that. He says, let me just say that what they're saying is that what this judge is saying in Oklahoma, a federal judge, is that individual rights trump the common good. That's right. She says, and especially, I say, when the individual is a foreigner with a foreign culture and foreign behavior, it seems that way to us, doesn't it? And the public interest as used in the French Republic and others is what I put on that program page is not the same thing as the common good, because it encourages the freedom of individuals, each with his own separate interest, as long as he doesn't harm others. Well, in other words, the public interest is upheld, it's in the public interest to uphold individual rights, even when they conflict with one another, apparently, because Muslim law conflicts with Christian law. So how do you allow both? By calling it religion, I think, and guaranteeing religious freedom. So Christians can think their way, but what about the law? Well, somehow Muslims can have their own law. How does that fit in? It doesn't fit in with the common good in any way, shape, or form. But it does fit with this crazy idea about individual rights, which has gone, obviously it's gone too far. Freedom of individual and individual rights has seemed so attractive and makes so much sense over the years, but today it obviously has gone too far, and it's being used to break up a good society, and particularly a society made up of people of a common background and common ethnicity and so on, because you can have any individual who comes in there has to be protected as to his own interests and his own rights and desires and so on. So that's one item. And by the way, this is a good time to mention that next Monday on this program, on the 26th of August, this will be our quarterly White Network powwow. I'm calling it a powwow now. And so Tan Stoffel and Hadding Scott will be on the program with me. And we'll be discussing some issues some of these issues that came up in Saturday's show with Vincent Renoir. And this distinction between common good and individual good will be a part of that. And also the whole question of who's to blame for the situation that white people are in today. That came up with Vincent too. And there's, he thought, again, it's up to white people to do something. And, there's a difference of opinion on that, but there are a lot of people who think the same way that he expressed himself. So we'll be getting into that next Monday. The second item I want to bring up is, from Osder Schwerter, the German blog, and this appeared on August 1st. And it's just one part of a long sequence of different items that they mentioned that were really interesting. And this one fits here because it's a quote, supposedly a quote from Heinrich Himmler that says, Islam is very similar to our world view. That's supposedly what Heinrich Himmler said. And the question they ask is, when did he say this? Or maybe it's where. They say that on April 25th of this year, there was a poster, and they say they dealt with it there on their blog, but I didn't see that. But that a Mr. Sturzenberger had shown in Munich, and with this Heinrich Himmler quote, I'll repeat it, Islam is very similar to our worldview. Now, they say, since this statement is factually incorrect, this is the writer of the blog. Since this statement is factually incorrect in my view, I wanted to research, this is a Google translation, so it's kind of bad, in which the relation to, the context in which Himmler said this to, because he at first thought, well, Himmler must have said it, but it doesn't sound right. So he said he suspected that Himmler may have said it to a group of Islamic Waffen-SS soldiers to kind of, make them feel better, soap them up, they say, lubricate them a little bit, make them feel better. But because there were some units of Islamic units in the Waffen-SS. But the writer says here, the German says, to my surprise, I found absolutely no source for this quote, although there were many hits on it. You know, if you look up a Google search, you find a whole lot of items saying it, referring to it, where you can go and see how it was referred to. But he said that, as so often happens, they all went back exclusively to this one poster thing in Munich. That's where they all came from. And I found that to be true myself. And he said a search in English didn't find the quote at all. Nothing on it at all. But in German, it was related to that one poster. So he says basically it's totally irrelevant from the thing itself. What fascinates me is the mechanism by which such a statement can occur suddenly and then accepted unquestioningly and spread around on the internet. And I've talked about this before. It's so true. So often when you find things, if it doesn't sound quite right, if you look it up, you will find that it comes from one place and it's been repeated by many people who pass it around on the internet. Unquestioningly, that's the most important word. Why we accept things unquestioningly, I don't know. But we've all done it at one time or another, because when something fits what we'd like to believe, or if it just seems like it's real interesting and new, we want to pass it around and say, oh, look here what I found. Did you know this? And we just don't do the due diligence that we should. So that's, I thought that was real interesting. Because I talked about another Himmler quote a few programs ago, that the Himmler in his speech to the SS officers about the so-called extermination plan that they were had underway at the time, and how what he actually said, and if that was even if he even said that in the speech. But so this is another one. They like to attribute things to Himmler because people will believe anything about Himmler, and it's hard to find out whether it's real or not. So this one is not. So I've got two main stories I want to talk about tonight. I had to cut out some other things that that I thought were interesting too, because I knew I would not be able to finish it all. So the first one I'm going to talk about is Angela Merkel's visit to Dachau. Now this has come up as a kind of a story. It's not the biggest story in the news, but they've made a lot out of it, and it's what I call a good example of phony news, because it's not a big deal. And Angela Merkel has kind of, I think, come under pressure to make a short visit to Dachau, because they've been wanting, or it's been a long time, that these people who are interested in promoting the evil that took place at Dachau, been wanting to get German dignitaries to go there, and no German chancellor has ever gone. And the little history about that, I think I'll give the history first. Makes sense. Let's see here. Where is it? Oh, goodness. Way down here. They wanted Helmut Kohl to go to Dachau in the 90s, and he, I think it was 91 or so, and he refused to go. He was chancellor then. And here's a story from 1985 in the LA Times about President Reagan. And March 22nd, he said that he had decided not to visit the site of the Nazi concentration camp during his trip to Europe because he wants to focus on peace rather than the past. Now, he was going to Europe because the celebration of the of the world 40th anniversary of the end of World War II, and they were having a big big get together somewhere in Europe, and all the world leaders, and so there were, now here it says there were some Jewish organizations that had suggested that he visit the concentration camp at Dachau, just north of Munich, so that it says there that it was the Jews who wanted him to go there. But he said that he added that he believes West Germany's present sense of collective World War II is unnecessary. Of course, the LA Times adds, in which millions of Jews were killed. But anyway, it was the ceremonies about marking the 40th anniversary of the end of the war, and Jews were pushing for him to go to Dachau. And the thing is, why it's always them who want these people to go to Dachau. I do, just like Obama went to Buchenwald in 2009. Who and Merkel met him there, and who was pushing that? Who was there with him? Elie Wiesel. You know, Elie Wiesel was taking him around. Elie Wiesel was the one who got him to do that. And they always want to do it. Now, in this case, it was very important because the 40th anniversary, it was talking about World War II, and they always want to make World War II about their Holocaust. So this is why they would have been really working on Reagan to go there, to make it tie in the Holocaust with, you know, all about World War II. And but Reagan said at the time, and see, it was easier then. It was easier then than it is now, I do believe. I don't think we've made progress. I think we've we have lost, I think it keeps getting tougher and tougher. Reagan said, I feel very strongly that this time, in commemorating the end of that great war, that instead of reawakening the memories, we should observe this day as the day when 40 years ago peace began. And he said he had discussed it with Helmut Kohl, and he said the German, West German chancellor felt the same way, that we could observe this as the beginning of peace and friendship between us. And then Reagan said, they have a, meaning the Germans, have a guilt feeling that's been imposed upon them, and I just think it's unnecessary. I think they should be recognized for the democracy that they've created and the democratic principles they now espouse. And then he said, in an aside, he said, there are very few alive that remember even the war, and certainly none of them who were adults and participating in any way. But then the LA Times has to add, in fact, however, thousands of Nazi war veterans are still alive, and Chancellor Kohl was 15 when the war ended. And I thought, my gosh, 15. What responsibility did he have for it? He was there then 9 years old when it started. What did he have to do with it? And why should he have to be, taking any kind of responsibility for it? Anyway, to go back up where I was, that's what Reagan did in 1985. And Kohl never went either, K-O-H-L. But now they have gotten Merkel to go. And she's going to be there tomorrow night. And it's going to be as discreet as possible. I'm sure she won't, because she probably wants it that way. I'm not trying to defend Merkel, but I do only to the degree that I don't think she's all gung-ho about this, but that she's been kind of, and of course, you know, elections are coming up, so she's kind of pushed along. Here's the story, the background story. She's going to be shown through the Dachau by Gabriel Hammerman, who is the director. And tagging along is this Max Mannheimer, who's described as a survivor. And I guess he has been around there for a long time. He was an inmate at Dachau all that many years ago. He's in his 90s or something. And he's been living in Dachau ever since. He never left. And he hangs around there. And so they have to, you know, they have to acknowledge him. And notice that her name is Hammerman and his name is Mannheimer. They both have the word man in their names. But the press is not going to be allowed to go inside when Merkel goes inside. They're going to congregate outside, but she wants to have a private tour, and they're not going to be allowed to go along, which is a good idea. And then this story says, with all this, phony news, that in 1933, Dachau was a model for all the later concentration camps. About 200,000 people were imprisoned here. 43,000 were murdered. See, now there's a lie. There weren't 43,000 who were murdered. I didn't look up the number, and who knows what's accurate or not, of how many died at Dachau. But if they died, they weren't necessarily murdered. Some would have been executed. It's true, but execution is not considered murder except when you're, you know, telling the story about German concentration camps. So then they say that it didn't become an official memorial until 1965. They were promoting it as such, but it didn't become official until 1965. You know, the whole thing is that nobody was anxious for this thing to become a big memorial, a place that stayed around forever, except, you know, certain groups. And they say that it was under the pressure of survivors. And for survivors, you should read organized communists and leftists. At the very least, there weren't a lot of Jews in Dachau. So, but there were a lot of communists and leftists, because that was the kind of people that they put there. And people who were against the National Socialist regime, though, those who were, you know, the opposite of that. So they are the ones who formed this, had a survivors group, and they're the ones that formed the committees to make this official memorial. And they're the ones who run it today. They've been running it all along. They're the ones in charge. And there is a group that's outside of Germany that has an official name that is officially runs this Dachau memorial. They call it a concentration camp sometimes, but it's not a, it's not that, and it can't be called that because it's a memorial museum place. So then in the mid-80s, Dachau mayor, a man named Meyer, didn't like the idea of it being there. He thought it would harm the reputation of the city of Dachau. And it really has. Dachau is a lovely city and a small city. And it's just associated with this, you know. And he was looking out for this, for the well-being of the city and its citizens. But he says, but then a youth center was, they got a youth center created there in 1981. And, but there was initially no sympathy for the youth club. And it was, not until 1998 that they finally opened up a community center. This is what this story says. Now, this is German. This is from a German. This is a translation of this German article. And then at the beginning of 2000, the Dachau City Council was still was bitterly disagreeing about the design of this community center and of the, they call it now a visitor center, and they were redesigning it, I guess, and they were arguing about, didn't agree on where the visitors should enter in because they were entering through the prisoner's house or something like that. But then they say that during the past 10 years, the attitude has changed. So, you know, everything has, all this resistance has just died away, which is not good. But the current Dachau mayor is named Peter Burgel. And he's a member of the Christian, what is that? Christian Social Union Party, Merkel's party, a lawyer. He's a lawyer who says he appreciates beautiful cars, good wine, and modern art. I guess he's made a lot of money. How, why he was elected, I have no idea, but he gave a speech in 2005 in the Dachau Palace, that's in the town there, that was a turning point. And I don't know, I guess he just made such a good speech that people liked him. So he's 60 years old, and he's a person who's been very open, says this memorial director, Hammerman. And she says he's very concerned about the memorial. He's really trying to build it up, and but slowly and quietly. He's always has reconciliation in sight, she says. Well, she, as the head of the memorial, this Gabriel Hammerman, she is she has got to be a communist or one of those leftists, or she's working for that organization, so she's in agreement with them, and they want to do everything they can always to make their to bring more people to their site there. And Burgel says that, well, he's, I'll just say that he is said to have improved the attendance of the memorial, and that's what they're after, I just said. And he's going to take the there's a Dachau exhibition they put together. He's going to take it abroad to Atlanta, Georgia, I guess, or to Holland. And now he will also travel, in September, to France, to the Oradour-sur-Glane site, where the where the SS supposedly perpetrated a massacre in 1944, and there President Joachim Gauck is going to be there and meeting with President French President Hollande. So they're going to be making a big deal out of Oradour-sur-Glane, where they lie about what the SS did there, and this German president and this mayor of Dachau are going to go there and help them out, help the French do that. You know, the French have a lot of interest in promoting what terrible things the SS did to their wonderful resistance fighters and innocent village people and so on. And so they're going to help them out with that. Repeatedly, Bergel was also in Bergel was also in Israel. He goes to Israel all the time. He's trying to make contacts with Yad Vashem Memorial in Israel. And he had this idea of twinning Dachau with the Israeli Rosh Ha'ajin, which is some kind of a Holocaust thing in Israel. If it says Ha, it's usually about Holocaust. But this failed because of resistance from Holocaust survivors. I guess the Holocaust survivors in Israel didn't want any twinning with Germany. But he also has said that he did succeed in forming a partnership between the Amper Clinics in Dachau and the Kaplan Medical Center in Tel Aviv, which is they're going to have a medical exchange. Why, it's so important, isn't it, to have these exchanges with the Israelis and Dachau, because Dachau has so much to live down, and they have to be extra special, nice, and friendly to Israel. And Bergel, I can't tell what his, this keeps being spelled differently, also brought his entire city council to travel to Auschwitz. So this guy is really gung-ho. And I looked him up, you know, but he seems to be, I can't find anything about him, not much at all, period, but that he is a German. And there are Germans like this who are just gung-ho because they are of a particular political persuasion. So he also says, and others have said too, that this NSU trial that I've talked about, and they call it the NSU process, has meant that it is increasingly, the people are increasingly occupied with the subject of National Socialism. And they said that visitors who come to Munich and they hear about the NSU trial going on, then they have their mind is brought around to National Socialism and the Holocaust and so on, and then they're more likely to visit Dachau while they're there. So that's what they're saying. And then further, they bring something up. This mayor says that the former SS shooting at Heberthausen, they've got it spelled wrong, but Heberthausen, where 4,000 Soviet soldiers were shot. Now they say 4,000 Soviet soldiers. Other places it says prisoners of war would have to be. Must be prepared, as well as many outdoor camp memorials. So they're going to now try to build up this thing at Heberthausen. Well, I never heard of it, and I didn't know nobody else I talked to had ever heard of it either. But I looked it up, and it was really hard to find anything. I'm going to have to skip down again to find out what I've got about that. All right, I found something on the Third Reich in Ruins site. Near north of Dachau, there's a village. Excuse me. There's a village of Heberthausen, and the SS had a shooting range there for firearms training, because there was a lot of SS buildings. You know, there are a lot of SS stationed around Dachau, and they had buildings and they had their stuff and so on. And they had a shooting range here, and they had pictures of it there. The Third Reich in Ruins site. And it said there that the SS executed some 4,000 Russian prisoners of war there. However, you can't find much about that anywhere, or if anything, except on these real hateful sites where they mention it. But they've only picked it up from, you know, somewhere like this, and they don't really know anything about it. Nobody knows anything about it. Where's the evidence that they were executed so many Russian prisoners of war there? And why would they do it when they needed labor so much? And they had lots of labor camps, sub camps all around Dachau, doing all kinds of important work that they needed done. Anyway, there was a concrete bunker at the end for a bullet trap, and it's still there. You can go and see it. And also there is a memorial to the murdered Soviet soldiers, which stands on the site. But where's the evidence? Here's another thing I found. The only other thing I found was that this smccd.edu site, some educational site or university site or something. And it says, it said, at Hebertshausen, not far from Dachau, the Nazis built a shooting range for the SS. It is estimated that 4,000 Soviet prisoners were executed there between 1941 and 1945. And then it has in parentheses footnote. So I take it that this statement is from a footnote, in somewhere, but I went to what they linked to. It was at the, where was it? At the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum website. And this, they had this here. This, and it says it was from a footnote, but they don't show you at all and I where that would be. And I didn't have 3 hours to spend looking all over the USHMM site trying to find it, which I don't think would be there. So, you know, this is something that somehow, this could very well be, you know, I can't call something a lie that I can't say, you know, I know that it is, but I think it probably is. Somebody started saying this, and then it's just a few people picked it up, because they have, you know, it adds to what they have to say about it. But what I'm thinking is that, this mayor of Dachau now, in his, all of his enthusiasm, is gonna they're gonna try to resurrect this whole idea at Hebertshausen to add to the fact that the Germans, were killing Russian men, like crazy. You know, in fact, there's some information there I came across that, a couple million they murdered. I don't think so. I don't think it was quite like that. But to get back to the story then, let's see. So I covered this part. So that's the end of it. This particular one, Max Mannheimer, his final statement was, "I'm proud to be an honorary citizen of the town of Dachau." So there is, there is this guy who was, you know, who had been a prisoner at Dachau, and he's an honorary citizen of the town, and he's going around. And in another story, they say that he is the director of the memorial. Here it is in the Times of Israel. The same story about Merkel. The Times of Israel says, Merkel will be joined on her visit by Holocaust survivor Max Mannheimer, director of the site, and by Bavaria's education minister. Now, you know, I've noticed in another Times of Israel, or was it that? It might have been that or a different one, but Jewish stories where they actually change things, and you can see where they've changed it. Somebody is editing these stories, and to make them say things that they shouldn't say, or to take out things that they did say that are too much obvious is not true. So this one, it could be that it originally said Holocaust survivor Max Mannheimer, because then there's a comma. And then the other woman's name, you know, that woman's name, Hammerman, director of the site, and Bavaria's education minister, but they took out that woman's name so that it reads Max Mannheimer, director of the site. Either that's ignorance or that's on purpose. I would say it's probably on purpose, so there's another lie. This story goes on. Well, it's the same thing that I've already said, so I can move past this. All right. Let's see, 8:40. What else do I need to do before I'm going to skip another whole story because I don't think I have time for it, and I'm going to see what comes up next here. I think I'll just mention briefly this thing in Der Spiegel. Yeah, there's a lie here too. Der Spiegel had just recently came out with, and I'm sure many of you have seen it, that Germany is set to become the first country in Europe to introduce a third indeterminate gender designation on birth certificates. I can't believe that Germany will do this. I thought they were too conservative to do a thing like this first. It says the European Union is attempting to coordinate anti-discrimination efforts across member states, but is lagging behind on this issue. But Germany is going to go ahead, supposedly, and add the option blank for in your gender choice on your birth certificate of your child. You're going to have male, female, or blank. That's going to be available in Germany from November 1st. Well, obviously, you don't have to add that, but it's going to be there. You know, as a choice, it's going to be printed there. And the legislative change allows parents to opt out of determining their baby's gender, thereby allowing those born with characteristics of both sexes to choose whether to become male or female in later life. That's exactly what it says. Now, who is born with characteristics of both sexes? Nobody's born with characteristics of both sexes. Unless you're a very, very unusual, you know, one in a million or something, freak. You know, I'm sure there have been children born with the characteristics of both sexes. But they are maybe not one in a million, but close to it. They are very, very rare, and that's considered freakish, you know. And maybe they do some surgery to turn the child into one or the other. I don't know. But this is not some common thing. If you are, what are they talking about here? This is just a lie. People will read this stuff and they'll, where was this at? Let's see. This came from, I already said, Der Spiegel, in international, in English. This is in English. To make people read this stuff and think, oh, well, they have some reasons. Oh, well, they have, you know, it makes sense. It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. But they say that, you know, what they're saying here is that you can choose now. You're born and we're not going to give you a sexual identity. And we're going to leave it up to you that after you grow up, you can choose whether you want to be a male or a female. Good grief. They make it sound like, well, this is for people who are born with characteristics of both sexes. Are they trying to say that these are people who are transgender or whatever they call it? And how do you know that when somebody's born? And so these parents who are open to this kind of thing will say, well, we don't know what our child is going to end up being or wanting to be or whatever. So we'll select blank and let them determine it on their own as they get older. Well, this is really some sick stuff. Really sick. Now, I'm going to go on now to my second story because there's a lot about this that will probably fill up the second hour. So, and of course, I can always take phone calls if anybody wants to call in about what I've been talking about. And the next story is from the Daily Mail. In fact, I've got two from the Daily Mail, and I didn't think I'd get to this other one, but I might now. you know, this is what got me started on this, was this story in the Daily Mail earlier last week. Okay, it's a real stupid story. It's one of these sensationalist type things called, was the mastermind of the Great Escape linked to the death of Hitler's hangman? Well, you know, they've got pictures of Reinhard Heydrich and pictures of this Roger Bushell, who they're trying to make into a hero. And so to try to give an introduction to this, it says that there's a new book that has now suggested, they use the word suggested, that pilot Roger Bushell could also have been linked to the assassination of notorious Nazi officer Reinhard Heydrich, known as Hitler's hangman, and the acting Reich protector of Bohemia and Moravia. Now, with whom was he known as Hitler's hangman? That came by, you know, that was wartime propaganda, or it came afterwards that those words were used for him. Certainly nobody in Germany ever thought of calling him Hitler's hangman, or did they? But anyway, this book is written by someone named Simon Pearson. And you know, the Daily Mail often makes a big deal out of new books that come out that are very supposed to be exposing some new aspect of the Third Reich or Hitler or the Holocaust or anything like that. And this is another one of those. But it's this Simon Pearson sounds like a very ordinary writer, and he's named his book The Great Escaper, and he places Bushell in Prague at the same time that Heydrich's car was bombed. And therefore, somehow he's able to, I suppose he's trying to find some threads here and there. Some of them are in here, that can say, well, maybe because he was in Prague, he had something to do with this assassination. Maybe he was helping. Because they are, in my opinion, and I'm going to sum up with this, that they are hard up for heroes, the British. They really want to create a World War II heroes out of people who are maybe semi-heroes and, you know, add to it and so on. So that's what this guy is doing. And so he's getting a lot of help with it. In fact, his book is being serialized in the Times, the London Times, you know, the big paper of London, although of Britain, although, you know, it's not what it used to be. It has too much competition, and it's not the highest circulation newspaper in Great Britain anymore, like it used to be, I found out. I'll talk about that at the end. So Pearson writes and admits that it's not known for certain whether Bushell was involved in the... whether Bushell was involved in the assassination attempt. But he writes about it anyway, you see, because it's a good topic, and he knows it'll sell, and so he's gonna write this book, and he's got the Times backing him up. And he says, you know, this part is what they say in this Daily Mail article. And I want to tell the real story. But I'll just say that he mentions that Bushell was known as Big X, and he had been hiding in Prague for a number of months. And the Daily Mail says that brings in this woman named Blazina Zaitamlova, who worked for the resistance, and she, according to him, offered shelter to Bushell. Bushell was a pilot. I haven't even talked about who he really was yet. But then they bring up that her family had previously attempted to kill the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler. You know, I'm sure it's easy to say that people tried to kill Heinrich Himmler, but, I don't know what kind of, evidence they have, what kind of, data they have for that. But then they say that, they talk about what happened to Bushell, But I'm going to skip that. I will just say here that Paul, that there was a book already about this Roger Bushell. It was called The Great Escape, titled. It was written back in, I don't know when it was written. The author was Paul Brickhill, and it was made into a film, a feature motion picture, with Richard Attenborough playing the title role. And but, you know, in the film, they said the character bore little resemblance to the actual man. So they even renamed him. They renamed the hero Roger Bartlett from Roger Bushell. I guess they didn't like the name Bushell. Roger Bartlett, and Roger Bartlett bore little resemblance to the actual man. So there's, you know, Hollywood fakery at work, whereas they turned out this big film, which some of you may have seen. I don't recall ever seeing it. But it has little resemblance to what actually happened to the actual characters. So I looked up Roger Bushell, and the best source to find out about him was, I thought, Wikipedia. Because they give you the version that is politically correct, you know, that they want to have out there. So, and they give a lot of detail. So Bushell was the commander of he was a lawyer and young guy and successful. He was in the upper classes, you know, always from his youth. Went to good schools. And then he wanted to learn flying, and like a lot of these upper-class British guys, they joined the RAF Reserves type, something like that, where they could learn to fly and practice flying on the weekends and so on. And then, October 9th, then he became, he was a reserve officer, and he was given command of the 92nd Squadron, and he was squadron leader. Became squadron leader, which was confirmed on January 1st, 1940. So now we're getting close to the opening of the first part of the war. During the squadron's first engagement with enemy aircraft on May 1940. So this, you know, Hitler started this his advance into France and Belgium and so on. In May 1940. So it was just starting, and his squadron was on a patrol near Calais, it says, and this was their first engagement with enemy aircraft, and immediately Bushell was shot down. And probably, they say, the one who shot him down was Oberleutnant Gunther Specht. And I could tell you about him a little bit, but it's really not too important. But he became quite an ace. He won German Cross, that highest decoration that they give out. And he had whole lots of wins and so on throughout the war. But he was killed in January 1945, finally, himself. But he is probably the one who shot down this Roger Bushell. And Roger Bushell crash-landed his Spitfire on German-occupied ground and was immediately captured before he had a chance to hide, they say. So this was, you know, this had to be a big disappointment to him. But, you know, it didn't have much to show. You know, here, as soon as he gets involved, he's immediately, you're not supposed to be shot down, you know, if you are shot down, you're supposed to be able to somehow get to your own territory, but he didn't. And so I would say this was kind of a failure, and it had to leave him with the feeling of not a good feeling whatsoever. So immediately he became a POW and was sent to the Dulag Luft Transit Camp near Frankfurt. And at the Dulag Luft, he was made part of the permanent British staff under senior British officer Wing Commander Harry Day. The permanent staff's duty was to help newly captured Allied aircrew to adjust to life as a POW. Well, you know, the British POWs under the Germans had a real nice situation all the time. They were treated very well, and of course they ran their own business, their own camps, their own barracks, and so on. They were able to run it themselves, and the officers were in charge, and you know, they just had a regular military thing going on under their own British command, and they were supposed to follow the rules. We get back to the Hague Convention and so on. They didn't have any right to make unreasonable demands. They had, you know, they didn't have any right to try to escape. They didn't have any right to do, you know, but as long as they cooperated, and the German security staff was very pleasant to them, and they had a lot of rights and so on. Nothing, they didn't suffer at all. But the only thing that was tough for them, particularly the officers, were that they, and here these were early in the war, were now, instead of fighting with their fellow, you know, soldiers and so on, which they wanted to do, they were now sitting in a POW camp, and they looked like losers. You know, they weren't, and they are there for the duration. They weren't ever going to get in the war. And this was hard for a lot of them to take, but especially for the officers who traditionally were expected to try to escape. Not the enlisted men, but the officers were expected to try to escape, even though that was against the Hague Convention. But that's the way it was with the British. Now, I'm going to stop here, and when I come back, ladies and gentlemen, I'll go on with this story about Roger. Michelle, and we'll see what's wrong with him.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour. On August 2013. And, we're talking about phony news. And I'm talking right now about this story about Roger Bushell and, the possibilities that he might have been involved in the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, for which I cannot see any evidence whatsoever. But it is an attempt to simply keep talking about World War II by the British and creating heroes and trying to make their guys look like they were doing outstanding, you know, heroic deeds, and outwitting and outsmarting the Germans. So, I'm going through the real story here now, not the phony story. And it might be fairly phony too, but, the British pilot officer, squadron leader, Roger Bushell, he's now in this, camp, whatever it's called. Anyway, he gets together with another, pilot officer commander, Harry Day, and, another, pilot, Jimmy Buckley. He must have been officer too. And the three of them made up what they called an escape committee. And they worked on it. They dug a tunnel. This tunnel business seems to have been really done quite a lot. At least that's what he did all the time. They dug a tunnel to the fence, and we'd get underneath it, I guess, or something, and from their barrack. And in June 1941... they had it ready, and what happened was that Bushell hid in a goat shed in the campgrounds. He didn't go through the tunnel, but others went through the tunnel, and as soon as it was dark enough, he crawled to the wire, and he made his escape, and the others, there was 17 others who had escaped in the tunnel, including Day and Buckley, his two partners. This is a little confusing. And then, but Bushell was recaptured on the Swiss border, only a few hundred yards from freedom by a German border guard. So he didn't get away. He got out of the camp and he was on his way, but he was recaptured. So, it says he was treated well. So they didn't do anything to him because of his escape attempt. They, you know, accepted it and they had got him back again. And they treated him well and returned him to the Dulag Luft camp. Him and all the 17 others who had escaped, including Day and Buckley, who they also caught, were transferred to Stalag Luft 1. And after that, they were transferred to an Oflag XC at Lübeck. Now, Lübeck is way north in Germany on the Baltic Sea. and it's still Germany. Lübeck was really heavily damaged by Allied air attacks during the war. Anyway, so now we get to October 1941, and they were moving these men again somewhere, and the train stopped briefly in Hanover, which is in the northern part of Germany too, not as far north as Lübeck, where, and at that point, Bushell and a Czech officer, who was a pilot, who was with him, Jaroslav Zafuk, jumped from the train and escaped. And so, you know, because escape was always on the mind of this man. And they made their way to Prague. And, you know, he was with this Czech, so he knew his way around Prague, and he spoke the language and so on. So using this Czech's contacts, they connected with the Czech underground movement, so it says. And they stayed in safe houses while arrangements for their onward journey were being made. So they're now, it's now, so now he's in Prague and he's hiding, waiting to get some, you know, to get some arrangements that will give him the, you know, ability to travel without being detected. And then the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich takes place in May 1942. And the Germans launch a massive manhunt throughout the city for the assassins. And during this, they round up Bushell and Zafuk. And they identified them. And so now Bushell was captured once again, and he was sent to Stalag Luft 3. Now, that's the third time he was captured by the Germans after he was trying to get away. And this was at Sagan, S-A-G-A-N. I don't know exactly where that is, but he arrived there in October 1942. So, you know, the time is going by here, and he's not getting out. There, Stalag Luft 3, that's his final place, he became known as Big X of the Camp Escape Committee. And he was the mastermind behind the mass escapes that occurred from the camp. Okay, so one of them became known as the Great Escape. That's what this book was, and this movie, film was made about. And this new book is called The Great Escaper, which is about the Bushell. This Great Escape was a big plan he had to, in which 200 men would be able to escape in a single night. And they would all have civilian clothes, they would be dressed in civilian clothes, and they would all possess a complete range of forged papers and escape equipment. And so they started digging tunnels. They dug three tunnels, Tom, Dick, and Harry, they named them. And in case one tunnel was discovered, they thought the Germans would think, well, they discovered the tunnel, and they wouldn't think that there would be more of them. See, that was their reasoning. So this was a huge plan, but where they were going to get all that forged papers and stuff, I don't know. But they had ways to do it. And obviously when these guys left, 200 of them supposedly, but I don't know if there were actually 200 left, they had all this stuff. So in the course of this time, while the tunnels were being dug, the tunnel Tom was discovered in August 1943. So we're already now in August 1943. And the other, it was nearing completion at that time when it was discovered. So instead of waiting for the other tunnels, Bushell organized another mass breakout, not in the tunnels, which became known as the Delousing Break. And it occurred on the 12th of June, 1943. This became known as the, 26 officers escaped by leaving the camp under escort with two fake guards, which were POWs disguised as guards, supposedly to go to the showers for delousing in the neighboring compound. Now, you can see how much freedom these British POWs had. I mean, how much they were able to do all this among themselves and contact people here, there, and outside and so on, and get the things that they needed, make all these plans and dig tunnels and so on, without being detected, because basically they were on a kind of a, you know, they were on a kind of a, what do you call that, on their honor. They weren't heavily guarded or inspected, or they were inspected, of course, but they weren't, you know, they weren't treated in any kind of a rough way. It was a, supposed to be a, you know, a show. They were supposed to be treated with respect and so on. And the Germans certainly did that. And, but all this time they were looking for ways to get out, to get away. And yet when this happened, these 26 officers left the camp. All but two were later recaptured. So once again, they didn't succeed, and they were returned to the camp. And then it says remaining two officers were sent to O Flag 4C at Colditz for attempting to steal an aircraft. So that was maybe the two that weren't recaptured at the time, but were later arrested because they had attempted to steal an aircraft. So this is the fourth time he was recaptured. Now, I don't know if he was in with this group of officers or not, but probably, maybe. Actually, I don't know, because they don't say. And these things never succeeded. You'd think that maybe they would say, well, let's give up and stop trying to do this, but they didn't. And they try to make this out to be a great quality of Bushell, that he never gave up. He was fanatical about it. But there were some, it came to some serious end finally. And in the evening of March 24th, 1944 now, we're already almost a year later, after months of preparation, they had a tunnel that was finished. And didn't say which one it was. It wasn't Tom, but didn't say if it was Dick or Harry. 200 officers prepared to escape, but things did not go according to plan, and only 76 of the officers managed to get clear of the camp. Now, they don't say why or anything like that here, but things didn't go according to plan. Maybe somebody came along and they had to stop going into the tunnel, and only, I don't know, or what happened, but Roger and had a partner now, Bernard Scheidhauer. Maybe they all had worked with partners to, you know, as they were going to leave, each with a partner. And they were one of the first to leave the tunnel and get out into the open. And they successfully boarded a train at Sagan Railway Station. They were caught the next day at Saarbrücken Railway Station, waiting for a train to Alsace. So that's how long they remained in freedom. The very next day they were caught. So this time the Germans had had enough of this, and no more being nice. And it says in here that Bushell and Scheidhauer were murdered 3 days later by members of the Gestapo. Murdered. Now, they weren't murdered. They were executed. There's a difference. But they don't want to ever say that. They don't ever use that word. They insist that all these people who were executed for a reason were murdered. And a side story on this is that there's this Emil Schultz who was one of the murderers, I guess. And he was found guilty in the Nuremberg, some of those war crimes trials. And there was a lot of controversy about that, because there are a lot of people who say, and he was hanged, and a lot of people say he shouldn't have been, that there was a confusion about that, and he was not so guilty. And actually they say that these men were all shot in the back of the neck in the Gestapo style. That's not the Gestapo style. So there's another big lie that they told, but I don't have time to go into do too much proving of that, but I just mention that. And in this article they say that it was a breach of the Geneva Convention to kill these guys, and so it constituted a war crime, that the Germans broke the Geneva Convention by killing them, because they say that the Geneva Convention of 1929 says escaped prisoners of war who are retaken before being able to rejoin their own, well, you know, before they manage to get away, if they are retaken, the army which captured them shall be liable. No, retaken by the army. Okay. These escaped prisoners shall be liable only to disciplinary punishment. I guess you could, somewhere it said you could put, they should have been put in solitary confinement and not executed. That this was a war crime. Well, according to the Hague Convention, though, they have no right to try to escape. And if they do, then they are subject to normal kind of punishment. Now, they didn't punish him much up until now, but now they finally had enough. And now we're in, you know, we're in 1944. The war is not going well at all. They are short of people. Do they have the facilities and so on to put all of these men in solitary confinement and take care of them and so on and so forth? At this point, things were getting much tougher. And anyway, they were executed, and 50 of them, of these who escaped and were recaptured, including Bushell, were executed by the Germans. Now, if this Bushell had not been encouraging these men to all try to escape all the time, they would have still be alive, you know? But they say that let's see, what am I trying to say here? So it says that Bushell, Bushell's great escape had prompted a massive manhunt. Yeah, you know, this is also very, very personnel heavy. You know, they had to put on a massive manhunt each time to go after and capture these guys. You know, and do they have time for that while they're fighting this war? While these stupid British prisoners of war playing their games of how brave and glorious they are. No, they don't. So it says that it had infuriated the Nazi regime, what they were required to do to look after these guys. So they just decided that they had done so many things that they were now going to execute them. I think they are in their rights to execute them, but even legally, probably, because look what the British were doing all this time. My God. But here they are. The British were furious, supposedly, that they had executed these men, and that especially that they executed Bushell, who they considered one of their best guys or something. And so those later on, the Allies tried and executed the perpetrators of who they thought were the perpetrators of these killings. Those police agents or whatever who did the executing, they found them, or they thought they found them, and they got testimony against them and so on. And they tried them in the war crimes trials and executed them. So it says that of the 76 escapees, 50 of them were executed. They keep saying killed and murdered, but I say executed in the at Stalag, from Stalag Luft. So that's the story of this man who's being idolized and glorified now, you know, in this book and in the Daily Mail. And I just say that the British need heroes, and they keep trying to build up heroes. The fact is, in my opinion, that National Socialist heroes are far more attractive to the public at large than any heroes the British have come up with. If you'd be honest about it, they have more mystique and more appeal because they're real heroes. They're not manufactured heroes. And this guy's a hero just because he kept trying to escape from a POW, from his POW camps. Okay. Well, you know, I know that when you're a soldier, you, and particularly if you're an officer, you don't want to spend the war in captivity, because then what are you going to say afterwards? And what are people going to say to you? I mean, you look, it's considered kind of cowardice. And so that's why officers are expected. It's their duty, it says, according to the British, to try to escape. And, you know, but they want to make big heroes out of everyone they can, the British do now. And think about Dennis Abbey, who I've done quite a bit of research and writing on. I mean, you know, he tried to make himself into a hero at the age of 90 years old. And they were all going along with it. The British were going along with it. Oh, yeah, we've got a new wonderful hero. Isn't he great? Look what he did. And yet it's all a big lie. And I don't know how much of this, there's not much to the Bushell story, so there's no reason that it should be a lie. There's just not that much to it. But they try to make it into something, you know, more than, they try to make it into something great. So, that takes me to, okay, the somewhere it was mentioned in here about the German peace treaty. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to really take a look at this treaty. And what it is, it's called the Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany, or the 2+4 Agreement. So, but here's the thing. This treaty was not, this treaty is recent. It was not signed until 1990. You know, all this time there was no treaty with Germany. But in 1989 and 1990, the Soviet Union collapsed, and the East Germany was no longer East Germany, and the Berlin Wall came down and so on. And so now there was all this talk about reuniting the two halves of Germany into one whole again. And so it says that in 1990, the four powers renounced all rights they held in Germany, allowing a united Germany to become fully sovereign the following year. Now that's a lie, you see. That's a lie because the four powers did not renounce all rights they held in Germany, if depending on how you want to look at it, how you want to interpret it. But it said that, you know, that once the Berlin Wall fell, the German people and the German governments, the two of the, you know, of the East and the West, made it clear that they wished to form a united democratic German state, and that to achieve unity and full sovereignty, they were willing to accept the terms of the Potsdam Agreement that affected Germany. Now, the Potsdam Agreement goes all the way back to 1945, I think it was, later in 1945, anyway, after the capitulation. And that was that meeting south of Berlin of Truman, Stalin, and Churchill, and then before it was over, Churchill had not been reelected, had lost the election to, can't think of who it was, Anthony Eden, was it? And, so he took his place there, but they were deciding on, you know, what was, how to treat Germany and so on. They'd already had plenty of meetings about that, but this was the final one. And so at this time then, in 1990, it was possible, it says, for the parties to negotiate a final settlement as envisioned in the Potsdam Agreement. So here you're going to have a free and sovereign Germany, but it's held to what was decided in Potsdam in 1945. What kind of a peace or freedom is that? It's not. So let's go on and look at this a little more. one of the most important elements of the Potsdam Agreement was that the Oder Neisse line, the Oder rivers and the Neisse River, which separate, you know, run down the eastern part of Germany, became the new border with Poland, and everything that was on the eastern side of the Oder Neisse line belonged now to Poland. And there's a lot that was always German that went to Poland. And that's why Gunther Deckert talks about the smaller Germany of today. That's a big part of what he's talking about, made Germany quite a bit smaller. But that was in the Potsdam Agreement, and Germany was not able to do anything about it. But now, in this new peace treaty, it's not a peace treaty, it's called Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany. Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany. No word of peace in there at all. And where was I? Well, Germany had to agree on the initial terms under which the Allies of World War II would govern Germany and the provisional German-Polish border, known as the Oder Neisse Line. What that means is that this border line now cannot be changed, or this new treaty that I just gave you the name of is no longer in effect. So it's not, you know, it's conditional. It's conditional on Germany agreeing to things that a real Germany would not want to agree with. And no free and sovereign nation is going to let anybody tell them what their borders can be, that they cannot try to change their borders in the future if they should feel that they had a right to do so or whatever. Nobody, you know, that's not sovereignty when you can't do that. So, but they insist on this. This is very, very important for the Allies. So, and this was also still the four powers had to sign this. All these years later, from 1945 to 1990, these four powers were still in control, and they had to sign off on this in 1990. And let's see. And it said that after the Soviets withdrew, the Germans could freely deploy troops in those areas, I guess, in the east, with the exception of nuclear weapons. So nuclear weapons are not allowed. Well, that's another condition. And then says that during the duration of the Soviet presence, Allied troops would remain stationed in Berlin upon Germany's request. Yeah. Because supposedly Germany wants the U.S. troops to be there. And, you know, they're still there today. They're still there. So again, I repeat, Germany does not have full national sovereignty. And another of the treaty's important terms was that Germany's confirmation of the internationally recognized, well, I got that one, the treaty, this treaty that they signed, prohibits Germany from making any future territorial claims. So not only do they accept the present border, they've agreed that it is forever, that they will never ask for anything more, that they will never make any territorial claims on Poland. And they even had to sign a separate treaty with Poland, which they did, in order to get this, whatever it is that they have, reaffirming the present common border, binding under international law, effectively relinquishing territories to Poland. This was done on 14th November 1990 with the signing of a separate German-Polish border treaty. So, you know, this is all very painful to German nationalists and people who, you know, feel like they want the true Germany to return. Very painful that this has happened. And another issue in this is that of NATO. Supposedly, according to some, like Mikhail Gorbachev, the former Soviet leader, and others, said that the Americans promised at this time that NATO wouldn't move beyond the boundaries of Germany after the Cold War, now that the Cold War was over. That means that NATO would never go past further east than Germany in trying to get members, you know, trying to build itself up. But now they say half of Central and Eastern Europe are members. So what happened to their promise? And Mikhail Gorbachev says it shows they cannot be trusted. Another little fact here is that Stephen Cohen asserted, a Jew, in 2005 that a commitment was given that NATO would never expand further east. But according to Robert Zoellick, another Jew, a well-known Jew in the United States State Department, who was involved in this negotiating process of the 2+4, this appears to be a misperception. And he says no formal commitment of the sort was made. Now, I think that is probably a lie. That's a lie from the United States, saying that they didn't commit to that. They probably used tricky words and so on, because others understood them to be saying that no further move to the east would be made by NATO. So these are just some examples of more things that are phony. This is not so much phony news, but phony information and so on, phony presentation of what is, and saying that Germany is now a free and sovereign nation when it no way is it. I don't know if it is at all, but certainly only if it adheres to conditions that have been put upon it that stem from 1945. And that, and the kind of attitude toward them that I've been talking about here. So, now I took care of that. I want to go on to another, I want to talk about the Daily Mail, but I have time. Okay. And, let me get to this other story if I can find it. Wonder what I did with it. Here it is. Another article in Daily Mail that is full of phony stuff was one that you might have seen last week, and that's the one about the toy soldiers that of what they call Nazi figures and SA figures that they have come up with. You know, one of these auction houses in England, has gotten hold of a lot of these toy soldiers and the little buildings and so on and things that kids use, you know, all over the world, and is selling them. And so this is the occasion. This presents an occasion for another big news story, where they can, talk about how the evil, Nazi Reich and so on, the Third Reich and all the terrible way that kids were brainwashed at that time. And so they paint this big story and they show these pictures. I hope you've seen them actually, of these innocent looking toy soldiers and some little buildings, as they said. And they try to make something out of it. And here's what they write. For the children of Nazi Germany, sinister toy soldiers depicting Hitler and his henchmen were top of their wish list during World War II. Miniature figurines of the evil German dictator, complete with an adjustable right arm to allow youngsters to mimic a Nazi salute. Well, most of them didn't have any adjustable right arm, but I guess this one of Hitler was a little bit larger that was made, and it did. These were among the sought-after toys used to brainwash children in the Third Reich, to brainwash them. Well, I remember a cousin of mine who was exactly my age, a male cousin, and visiting up there at his house, and he had all these toy soldiers, and it seems like there was some were red coats and some were blue coats. They might have been Civil War soldiers, you know, some were on horses and some weren't, and he had a lot of them, and he was setting them all out and, you know, doing things with them. And I thought they were really fascinating. But after I looked at them for a while, and, you know, I couldn't in myself find any interest in doing anything with them. I liked the idea of looking at them, but I didn't have any interest in setting up battles for them, which I guess is what he was doing. But, you know, there were quite innocent. I mean, as everybody knows, that these kind of things are made by toy companies for kids because they like them. And it might have been a much bigger thing at the time, because now we have internet and people have internet games and so on, kids do, whereas that time you had to have some real things like that. But here's some of the things about this, that the figurine, they say this in the story, and this is the Daily Mail again. Accompanying the Nazi leader, a figurine of his mistress, Eva Braun, and a podium emblazoned with the Nazi swastika. So they've got a picture of it there. And this is no more Eva Braun than I would be. I mean, less than that, because they've got this little figure, you know, she's not a soldier, but she's one of these little metal figures. She's much smaller than Hitler, and they've set her up there next to Hitler on this balcony or something. And she's in a BDM uniform, you know, the League of German Girls, the Bund Deutscher Mädel uniform. She's got black hair. She's just a young girl who's one of those, like the other side of the Hitler Youth for the boys. And yet they call her in this article, they call her Eva Braun. Now, why would they do that? That is so stupid. And they must know better. And if they don't know better, then I don't know what to say. And they've also got to show some figures of a little metal figure of Rudolf Hess. And then they say that other toys were found among these soldiers. Among the collections that were soldiers of Germany's Wehrmacht. These ones were the SA figures. Then there's some Wehrmacht soldiers. They don't show pictures of those, but they say, including two lying on the ground, taking aim with the rifle, and another charging with a bayonet. Like, oh my God. Oh, they're so violent, you know, these figures, and they, all for these little kids. And they say that these figures were mass-produced during World War II as part of the Nazi propaganda machine. You know, every country had these kind of figures. And then later on, we had G.I. Joe dolls, and we had all kinds of war stuff in the United States for kids because of the war. It's all very, very... propaganda-ish, but it wasn't the government putting it out, I don't think, and it wasn't the German government putting it out. This is toy manufacturers come up with this stuff on their own. They're not stupid. They know, you know, what kids would be interested in, or they find out and they make it. So, any more of this? So this guy at the auction house, he says, propaganda was so important that Joseph Goebbels told the makers to improve the features on the personality figures. Well, how does he know that? And yet, if Goebbels did mention to the toy makers that they should improve the features on the personality figures, it would be because Goebbels had a high level of taste and quality. In his way he wanted things to be. And so I looked at these figures. Yeah, they don't look very good. I mean, the Hitler had kind of a dumb, you know, wasn't all that well. His face wasn't all that good. And the Hess, too, they don't so much. You know, because they're just mass-produced stuff. And so he may have said, you know, if you're going to make these things, why don't you at least make the people, the personalities like Hitler and Hess and maybe even himself and Goering and so on, whatever ones that they would have been making, look better than you're making them look. He may have said that, but I'm sure it wasn't a part of his propaganda. And here's another little lie. He says, they say that toys were used to try and encourage children into the Hitler Youth. See, now that's just a lie. That they made these toys to try to encourage children into the Hitler Youth. Well, in the other kind of, you know, in other countries, they were talking, some of the commenters were talking about, they had these British soldiers. They had the same thing in Britain. And did they do that in order to encourage the kids to get into some kind of government program or whatever? This was just stuff, and you don't even know how popular these things were either. But the worst part was saying that this girl in the BDM uniform was Ava Brown. You know, Ava Brown never wore any uniform. She never was joined anything. She wasn't a party member. She didn't. She never went to anything like that, and she didn't dress that way. She never would have worn. She never had any kind of a uniform. So that's just really stupid. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Daily Mail because, you know, I've been talking about how these newspapers in Britain keep playing this stuff up. And I think it's pretty pathetic because, you know, Britain just lost big time from that war in the long run. Look at Britain today. And it doesn't make me happy to look at Britain today. But it's, you know, it's barely keeping itself together. And yet it's, and then because things are so bad there and they have nothing good to say, they keep running this World War II stuff. They keep running, stories and so on. Anything that comes along, they can make something big out of it to say, well, we defeated that terrible, horrible Third Reich and that terrible Hitler and those horrible henchmen of his and so on. We defeated them and they were so bad. And here's some more stuff about how bad they were and how evil they were and how they needed to be defeated. Because, you know, they lost everything in going into that war the way they did and to defeat Hitler and Germany. And they wanted to, you know, Britain had wanted to defeat Germany for a long, long time and keep Germany from being a true competitor, which they kept coming back to being. And yet, at the end of this, after World War II, Germany was certainly flat on the ground, but now they've come back. And Britain is lower on a lower level in every way than Germany is, and so it's ironic in a very pathetic way of what happened. So they keep one thing they can do is to talk about World War II, and they do it as much as they can, it seems to me. Now, why does the Daily Mail do this so much? The Daily Mail is an old paper. It was started in 1896. And it was, the originators were Alfred Harmsworth and his brother Harold. And Alfred Harmsworth later became Lord Northcliffe. Now, we've all heard of Lord Northcliffe. And Harold became Lord Rothermere. So they both became lords. Well, you know, in Britain, you buy these lordships. That's what you do. That's why there's so many Jews have them, because they've bought them. And they've been buying them for a long time. And these two men made money on their newspaper, and they then bought themselves a lordship. And they have some, you know, they get a name and so on. And it's pathetic. But this is what the Britons do. And they don't care because, obviously they don't care because they've got a lot of, they can hand out as many lordships as they want. And it's actually the party that's in power, the political party that's in power, that does it. And they get the money. I don't know, maybe the country, maybe the, They need the Queen's approval, but she just gives it if they ask her for it. If they say, here's the people we've recommended should get lordships, and she approves it. So that's how all these people get these things. I don't actually know where the money goes. But the party in power must get something from it, because they're the ones who are interested in selling them. And so this newspaper, the Daily Mail, that they started was an immediate success. It cost less than the other London dailies. It cost a half penny at the time. It was more populist in tone, and it was more concise than some of the others. You know, these British papers, particularly the Times, was very long-winded and, you know, wasn't as all that colorful at the time. So this one became popular, and the Daily Mail, and they had the first run was 397,000 papers, and they had to acquire additional printing facilities because they had a circulation which rose to 500,000 in 1899. So it's always been a big paper, and for all modern times. One of the biggest, and let's see, well, there's some criticism of it, but that's about all I want to say about that. Here, Lord Rothermere was a friend of Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, and directed the Mail's editorial stance towards them in the 1930s, and Rothermere's 1933 leader, I guess that was something that he led with in the newspaper, was youth triumphant, and it praised the new Nazi regime accomplishments, and was subsequently used as propaganda by the National Socialists. This was in 1933, well, when Hitler became chancellor. They were praising Germany at that time, the Daily Mail, and basically, the Daily Mail is known as a conservative paper. Did I say that already? Surprisingly. In it, Rothermere predicted that the minor misdeeds of individual Nazis would be submerged by the immense benefits the new regime is already bestowing upon Germany. So that means that this man who liked the National Socialists was calling them Nazis. This is interesting. Back in 1933. Okay, and Rothermere and the Mail were also editorially sympathetic to Oswald Mosley and the British Union of Fascists, and he wrote an article entitled, Rothermere did, Hurrah for the Black Shirts, in January 1934. Praising Mosley for his sound, common sense, conservative doctrine. And it says, this support ended after violence at a BUF rally in Kensington, Olympia later that year. Well, actually, I would say that all that kind of support ended when the war started, or maybe before that, but, you know, somewhere in the later 30s. Because it wasn't, became unpatriotic. So, and on this particular Wikipedia page about the Daily Mail, it's, what's interesting is that they skip the war period entirely. They have pre-war and then they have post-war, but they don't have anything, you know, what their philosophy was, but they don't have anything during the war. Well, I'm sure they were totally anti-German then. And they have been ever since. So this is something about what you have to be a patriotic Britisher, because you can, you know, in the 1930s, you could be positive toward the Third Reich, but not afterward. Now let's go to the Guardian. The Guardian is probably the second, most popular newspaper, and one that we see a lot online, a lot of articles. They have a lot of articles about Hitler and the World War II period in all ways, including Holocaust. They have a lot, not as many as the Daily Mail, which always has a couple every week, I'd say. At least once a week they have a major one that they write something about. But the Guardian writes things too, and they were founded in 1821. But they have what's considered a liberal agenda. I couldn't tell from these papers. One, you know, I don't read them enough to know, but this is kind of interesting that they're considered liberal, but not super liberal. They are identified with social liberalism today, and they supported the Liberal Democrats in 2010. And the Liberal Democrats went on to form a coalition government with the conservatives. So the Liberal Democrats are not as far left as the Labor government is. The Labor Party, I mean, the Labor Party. And there's also the Daily Telegraph, which does a lot of this Hitler bashing, too, regularly. And they are, they started in 1855. And they were, they are considered basically conservative, the Daily Telegraph. So you got the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph kind of conservative. And the, so far the Guardian is more liberal. Now you have the Independent. That's the one that's got a lot, I read a lot on online. And, they also have a lot of these anti-Hitler, World War II, pro-Holocaust and so on articles regularly. And they are considered leaning to the left politically. But they also are more pro-market stance. So, you know, and the Independent is owned by a Russian named Lebedev. And the Times, which is the best known, I've always thought, is not as, it does not have a high circulation as I thought. It's not as dominant as I thought it would be, but it's the, it's very old. It doesn't even say here when it started, but it's lost ground, I guess, to these other parties. And it's kind of a mix, more conservative, but also has liberal readers, has labor readers. It's owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. It's kind of mixed. But they all do this. They all attack Nazism. But it seems like the conservative papers, they say that the Mail and the Telegraph are more conservative, but they do it more than anybody, more than the others do it. So we're bombarded all the time with untruths, to put it mildly, that are mixed with basically truthful information. And much of this untruthful information gets passed on, repeated, and this is the intention. I believe it's intentional that they want these mistakes and these lies to be in there. They don't care. I don't know that they're just sloppiness. They want them in there, and then these kind of things get passed along, or they make the story sound more, more terrible, which is what they're after. So it is. It is something that needs to be watched out for. And I want to go back now. I've got about 5 minutes, so I can cover something that I passed by. Let's see. Sorry for this. I'm having to look for it. Well, going back to this lack of a peace treaty in Germany. There was an article on this Ostersverter blog that is titled "The Legal Situation in the Federal Republic of Germany: A Summary." This is bad translation. Something about power and violence, and what this person is saying there's no law in Germany, and the point that he's trying to make is that. And I've said this myself, and I totally believe it, is that there is no law. Law depends on who has the power. And if you have everything really comes from the ability of state power to enforce it, you know, to enforce what they want to enforce. And so people follow the law because they know they'll be punished if they don't. If people weren't punished, they wouldn't follow these laws. I mean, people would do... So, I mean, you need law, but you need real law and fair law. But what's behind law is always the violence of state power or somebody's power, some power. That's what makes people do what they have to do, or do what they're forced to do, or do what they are expected to do. Like, even if you have a contract, let's see if I have that here. Even if you have a contract that you've made with someone, you fulfill your, and it's legal, you fulfill your end of the contract, because if you don't, you'll get even worse penalties. You know, if you don't, the court will come upon you, the law will come on you and say, well, now we're going to fine you, or we're going to put you in prison for a while or whatever, because you broke the contract. You didn't live up to it. So people do these things because they know that they're going to be hurt if they don't. And he says that the situation in Germany is that, he says, it's not possible for us to recover our freedom through any legal subterfuges. Our situation is comparable to the Greek slave in ancient Rome. The dominus, or the landlord, decides on life and death over his slaves. He decides whether he treats them well and feeds them. And the slaves can ask for mercy, but they have no rights against him. And that's how he feels the Germans are, today's Germans are. And he said, suicide sounds hard, but the solution, some come to this solution. He said it was preferred by the vast majority of warriors against arrest and captivity in ancient times. And he says in 1945, thousands of officers of the Wehrmacht and the SS followed this path of suicide. He says people who were born into slavery, they don't know anything else. And so they're used to it. And that's like today's Germans were born into this, and they think they have the good life and they're comfortable. And so that is brings us to the end of this program, ladies and gentlemen. So thanks for listening, and good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.